Okay, so we'll sing, I think on the first side, it's the first part once and the second part three times in Tibetan. And then the English is next to it, so you know what you're saying. You want to lead? That's okay.
Sashi.
Puki shikshing eto cham. Re-raveling shin yin deg and padi. Sange sing du mikte uorgi. Drogun amda ching la chu barsho. Idam guru radna mandala kam yiryatayami. Chudang soki choknam la. Changchu vardu dakni kyatsu chi. Daki jin so ki pe sunam ki. Jola penchir sange jupa sho. Chudang soki choknam la. Changchu vardu dakni kyatsu chi. Daki shen yen gi pe sunam ki. Chola penchir sange jupa sho. Chirang soki choknam la. Changchu vardu dakni kyap su chi. Daki shen yen gi pe sunam ki. Chola penchir sange jupa sho. We'll start with the meditation. So come to a comfortable seated position. Can be in your chair on a cushion. Can be laying down if that is a position that's relaxing where your mind can be bright. And if it's comfortable sitting away from the back of the seat, and this meditation is a way just to arrive and transition from the busyness of the day. Start by bringing all of your focus to the crown of your head. There is nothing else to think about, no other place for your mind to be. And as you're ready, slowly scan your awareness down your body and release any tension, holding, any stress. Not by thinking through it or thinking about it, but just by placing your awareness there and letting the physical tension release. And you can spend extra time in any space that you come across where there's a lot of tension. Maybe there's some pain or something like that. softening the whole physical form while still sitting up straight and allowing the energy to move. And once you finish scanning down your body, then start to scan back up. When you reach the crown of your head again, change your focus to the breath. The movement of breath at the chest, or the belly, or the tip of the nose. If your mind jumps off somewhere, bring it right back to the breath. If there's tension building up in the body again, switch from the breath to that area. Release the tension and then go back to the breath just for a few more minutes. And expand your awareness back into the full body. Up through the arms and the legs. Feeling more of the sensations in the body. And when you're ready, you can start to move. Open your eyes. And make a dedication if you like. One clock is fast by a few minutes. And it's like that, like every clock in my house is always different. And so when I leave for work in the morning, I feel like I leave it one time and then I get into my car and my car is like 4 minutes ahead. So then all of a sudden I'm behind and I hate it. And it's been like a minute. But all of a sudden, I'm really behind. That's kind of what I feel like when I look at this clock. All right. Oh, I forgot to put what class. We are on class 4. And we're studying... What? What are we studying? The topic. Yep, the Bodhisattva vows. And what's the definition of a bodhisattva?
Someone who wishes to reach enlightenment to the benefit of all sentient beings.
Right. And tonight we're going to go over vows 1 through 9, the vows of the bodhisattva. All right, and then two more review. What's the main text that we're studying? Where these vows are coming from. Yep, the Highway for Bodhisattvas. And it's written by who?
Jason Kappa.
Mm-hmm. And where is he in this room? Yep. He's on that Tonka right there. And who knows his dates that he was alive?
1557 to 1480.
Mm-hmm. And does anyone remember the Tibetan of Highway for Bodhisattvas?
Jangchub Shunglam?
Yes. So it's Jangchub Shunglam. So that's the main book. Jason Kappa's book is the main one for all the difficult fine points of the vows. And then there's another one that gives a more to-the-point definition or presentation of the vows. Does anyone remember what that one's called? I love this name. Shining.
Shining jewels.
Yep, the String of Shining Jewels. And who is the author of that one?
Geshe
Sewang Samdrup. And does anyone remember the Tibetan? I think it's hard to remember the Tibetan. And this one's kind of a weird pronunciation. Yep. Norbai Utrang. Okay. So let's go to slide 2. And we're going to go over half of the root downfalls tonight. So we're going to go over 1 through 9. Which means there's how many root downfalls? 18. What did you say? 18, because we're going over half tonight. So basically a downfall means that if you break the vow, you're going to fall in your next rebirth. Basically you're going to fall to a hell realm in your next rebirth, which is a pretty serious consequence. So if you completely commit a root downfall, it destroys the vow in your mental continuum as well, which is where the vows form when you take them. But the good news is that to break one is very difficult because you have to have 4 different attitudes with it. And this is the benefit of taking a course like this that's more in depth with the Bodhisattva vows, because you can read them and they sound like they're very easy to break. but actually they're not as easy as they seem. And if you don't go back and review them, like I took them years ago, and after keeping them for a while and reviewing them all the time, you kind of just forget what the full meaning is, and you think you're maybe getting close to breaking one, but you're actually not. Not that it's not possible to do them, but it's more difficult than it seems, which is good news. So you have to have different attitudes in your heart to fully break one, and we'll go over those in a few weeks. But one of them, they're just kind of sick, you know, like you enjoy it, you want to do it again, you think it's not bad, that sort of thing. And when we go over them, you'll see that it's harder to do than it seems. So one of the kind of nice things about bodhisattva vows is that you can take them over again. So you can renew them and re-strengthen them. But once you break one of your root vows, you cannot attain the first bodhisattva bhumi in this life. Does anyone know what that is? It's seeing emptiness under the influence of bodhicitta. So in meditation, seeing ultimate reality, the way the world really works, which is how, like, the first step towards becoming an enlightened being. So seeing that in meditation with this love in your heart for all beings, the bodhicitta, that cannot happen in this life once you break one of your root vows. Does that mean it won't ever happen? No, just not in this life. It'll happen for all beings. That's the progression of, you know, of our entire existence. It may take countless lifetimes, but it will happen. So if you break one, it will not happen in this life, though. So you can take them over, but you'll still not see emptiness directly with true bodhicitta in your mind. This is according to Jason Kappa, who is a master teacher and founder of the Galupa lineage, which is the lineage that we're studying here. So when you study the vows well, which is what we're doing, they're very specific evil things, and they're not as general as most Americans think either. I don't know if this is still the case today. I think Americans are a little more well-trained in Buddhism, but I don't, you know, but not everybody. So after you have this knowledge, you can be of some help to people if you're talking to someone and they bring it up and maybe have a view about it that's incorrect, or they haven't studied it in a while, then you can help and say, well, it's actually this, so, you know, you haven't broken the vow, or something like that. And it's just really good for our own practice to know. So, long story short, it's kind of hard to break them. And there's a word that refers to the first 18 vows, and it's pampa. Say pampa. Pampa. And that means to be defeated by your enemy. Which, you know, right away just does not sound good. And who do you suppose the enemy is?
Yourself.
In one sense, yes. Yes. So what are the things that come up and make us do these bad things?
Yourself, maybe? Your animal nature? I don't know.
You could say partly.
The mental afflictions.
So these negativities that come up and take over, like anger, pride. You could say their instinct, because we've had that habit for so long that it comes up easily. So we have to fight against those things. And I think there's some sort of belief where if it feels natural, then it's right or something like that, which is just not true. Studying Buddhism for any length of time, we see this anyways, but if somebody yells at us or hits us, what's our natural tendency?
Never strike back.
Right. And if we understand karma or how the world works and emptiness, then we know that by doing that, we're planting the seeds for it to happen to us again. So it's completely 180 degrees wrong, our instincts, in most situations. It doesn't mean that we don't have intuition, but our natural instinct to hit someone back is just completely wrong. And I mean, we learn this in, I don't know, kindergarten or before, probably. So, anyways, Pampa is also the name of the monk's most important vows, which are killing a human being, stealing more than a certain amount of money, sexual intercourse with a woman, and lying about your spiritual attainment. Those are the monk's most important vows. So the first 18 of the Bodhisattva vows are given that name to show how serious they are. They're similar in seriousness to the breaking of the first four monk's vows, but the first 18 are actually much more serious because, why, we just mentioned it before. What happens if you break the vow completely?
Unfortunate rebirth, unable to attain the first Bodhisattva vows.
Yes. Good. So they're actually more serious. And the root vows are all called pampas or defeats. You've been defeated by your bad thoughts or your mental afflictions or this negative tendency that we've given into so many times that it's really strong and it feels easier to go along with it. The good side is that by keeping these vows, things will start to pop and change in our lives. And really, one of the major foundations for spiritual practice of any kind is ethics or morality. And the sad thing is that you meet practitioners who are getting discouraged, or they're going through a crisis, or they're getting bored, and it's because they're not keeping their vows, they're not following their practices. And, I mean, it's not always something that you're going to tell somebody, but you can know for yourself, and maybe if you're teaching one day, then you can share that this is the foundation, keeping our vows. Keeping our ethics really clean and pure will transform our world. And it's not that it happens overnight, although we do see changes right away, but it takes time. It takes practice and consistency and just showing up time and time again. And over time along the path, things smooth out a lot more. There's just a lot deeper happiness. A lot of things start to shift and change. And bad things still happen, but it's a lot different when we have a strong practice to rely on. All right, good, next one. Okay, so now we're on to root vow number one. Very exciting. The first one is praising yourself and putting down other people. And really, we probably don't say that to people, but we think this all the time. And maybe in our actions, it comes out a little bit, or our thoughts. So the motivation here must be that you're after material gain or the respect or admiration of others. So this one, on the surface, it looks like we're breaking it left and right, like all the time. Probably when we go to work, in like the first 5 minutes we've broken the vow. You know, something like that. So it's not as general as just putting others down. Not that that's a virtuous thing to be doing, but that's not breaking the vow. It's very specific. So our motivation, we have to be after two things: the material gain or the respect and admiration of others. So for the material gain, it's got to be something like you're going to get a house, you're going to get money, you're going to get a car. Particularly if you're teaching Dharma, you're putting down other Dharma teachers and holding yourself up in hopes that someone's going to give you like a piece of land or a big donation or something like that. So it's got a real like nasty vibe to it. You're teaching Dharma where you're supposed to be loving and caring for all beings, and you're bad-mouthing another Dharma teacher who's teaching, you know, probably for the same reason, in order to get some material wealth. So that would be the one. It'd be a desire or attachment for your gain. And then the second would be wanting respect or admiration of others. You don't need both. It could be either one. Any kind of gain. You're hoping that people will come and tell you what a great teacher you are. Or bring some sort of... No, that would be the first one, the offerings. Or, you know, build you like a big throne and just think that you're doing a great job. Something like that. Like you're... Like you don't have the motivation of helping people, you have the motivation of getting something for yourself. And you're bad-mouthing other people to do that. So the bottom line is... What we're not talking about is when there's another teacher or another group that's teaching something wrong. That's not what we're talking about here. It doesn't mean you can't ever say anything or that, you know, you have to be mute for the rest of your life. But in that situation, like if you see someone teaching something that's harmful for people, then in that situation, you're required to go and talk to them and ask them to have a public debate. That's the idea. And there's some stipulation with that, too. So you ask them to show you the scripture where they're getting these teachings, which they're not going to be able to show you if they're incorrect teachings. And the point is there, you're not hoping to be more famous than this person. You're just trying to help. You know that it's harmful what they're teaching, and you're trying to point that out. But you have to be doing it with kindness and like a love in your heart for them. And you have to have the scripture, and you have to have the knowledge to back up what you're saying. So it's very specific where you could do that. But the main examples they're giving are with teaching. I don't think that's the only situation. But that's the example that's given in the scriptures. You cannot correct them with any other motivation. It has to be out of love or caring or wanting to set the record straight. So that's not breaking the bodhisattva vows, that example. That would be keeping the vows. And then it also says if it gets, Jaitsan Kapa also says, if it gets to where the person that you're talking to is having a bad reaction, then you're supposed to back off too. And I think in spiritual practice, it's really, really confusing when to talk to someone about something and when you deal with it on your own in your own practice. That's always been really confusing for me from the start. I think before... practicing, I would just talk to everyone about everything that came up, you know, like I have a problem with this or this is difficult, that sort of thing. And after having a spiritual practice, it's less about blaming someone else or confronting someone else, and it becomes more important to look at our motivation. So am I just trying to unload what I'm feeling on someone else? Is that why I'm doing this? Am I trying to punish them in some way and just masking it under the guise of, I want us to talk about this? Really, I just want to make them feel bad. You know, that sort of thing. So, okay. I think we're getting off topic. So it can be either gain or fame, and it doesn't need to be both. And for you to commit this downfall, the person you're speaking to must grasp what you're saying. So the moment they grasp what you're saying, the vow is broken. And this mainly from the scripture, it seems to apply to a Mahayana person putting down other Mahayana persons. So the point is that it might result in a schism or breaking up a group of spiritual practitioners.
Okay, so we have our what if you're just going through the thought process and not actually acting out on it? Are you passively like think something negative about somebody else that has a karmic effect and it's breaking the vow, right?
I was actually just going to say that. So most of the bad deeds are speech are like this, where it has to be verbal, not just a thought.
Okay.
To break it, yeah. Thank God. So this would be, say, in the center, it would be talking bad about someone else because you want people to think better of you, or you want to teach a class or to be in charge of something or to get praise or material things in some way. It would be something like that, or something where you're trying to break up the group. That's what this is referring to. So it sounds very general, but it's actually very specific. But if you're in a community like this where there's Mahayana practitioners, it is possible to do. So we have to be careful if we're keeping these vows with our interactions with our Dharma brothers and sisters. And it's also said that what you're saying should probably be a lie in order to break this one. And this implies that the other person that you're dissing probably does have good qualities, and you're lying about this to somebody else. And interestingly, some of these are really hard for us to break, which is really nice. The secondary vows are not as hard. But in the text, it's on a really high level, this vow. It's like one cardinal dissing another to get all the money from the government or something like that. So it has to be pretty bad. And there's countless ways that we can come close to breaking this. But it's good that we know the exact point where we would actually break it. So if we practice in concentric circles, so here's breaking the vow, and then there's circle outside of it that's not breaking the vow, but kind of close. Then there's another one that's not breaking it, a little further away, and out and out and out. But if we're really careful all the way out here all the time, then we're never going to get here to break it. So it is good to be very careful and detailed in keeping your vows, but to also know that I'm not breaking it unless I do exactly this for these motivations. So basically the motivation would be to cause a split in the Sangha among Mahayana practitioners. So it really narrows it down. So there are two vows in here. The one for material gain and the one for the respect or admiration of others. So we'll come up with more than 18 at the end. We'll have a longer list. So the reason that they count it as one vow is because the motivation is basically the same. The motivation is desire, wanting other people's things, and respect. So there are... But then there are two from the point of actual activity. Does that make sense? Okay. Let's go on to number two. Okay, number two is not giving someone Dharma teachings or material assistance. And again, this one's very specific. So the other person should have one of the two qualities. The first thing, they must have a serious problem like a disease. They're impoverished. They're out of money. Some sort of problem like that. And number two, you are their only option. They don't have a network of support, family, friends. They're counting on you, depending on you, and you're the only one that can help them. So you must be able to help them. You have to have what they need. If you don't, say they're asking for money and you don't have the money or you can't get it, then you're not breaking this vow. It might be the concentric circles, but it wouldn't be breaking the vow. So the limitations on giving include not giving things which might cause harm, such as weapons, poisons, etc. So if someone begs you for a gun to, I don't know, kill their neighbor or whatever reason, then that would be something that would be causing harm. Or poison. The person's trying to poison themselves and they ask you to buy it for them. Or if you can get this sort of poison. You could look at it as like concentric circle would be drugs or alcohol, that sort of thing, that's harming someone. So
should I like rethink buying my friends a beer or whatnot?
Like, that would be like way out here. That's definitely not breaking the vow. And it's like, you know, maybe if they're an alcoholic, then it would be really harming them if they're having like a beer with dinner and, you know, something like that. So that's where you just use your judgment on it. So this one comes to the question too about euthanasia, because basically according to this, you can't do euthanasia. Believing, so you know that the person's going to hurt themselves. And you know, I would say that one's a pretty clear line, but all of us have to walk our own path, and you'd have to check in with your motivation, with your teacher, that sort of thing. But bottom line would be that would be killing. And in regards to this vow, it would be breaking it because you're giving them something that's going to harm them. And then for you, that results in not being able to see emptiness directly in this life under the influence of bodhicitta.
I guess also asking for euthanasia would also be similarly breaking the vow. And that's really dark, but
like assisted.
Yeah, flying overseas and,
it wouldn't be, I don't think it would be breaking this vow for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely not
a
good thing for the other person.
Somebody else to go against their own better nature and karma, and you would be encouraging their current collapse, so that would not be good.
Right. Okay. Not good, but I don't think it'd be breaking that vow for you. If they had their vow, mm-hmm. it'd be breaking it for them if they did it. But yeah, so we also have to be careful with this one, because I think in our lives this comes up a lot with homeless people asking for money, or, you know, people that we see on the street, that sort of thing. And we have to watch our intention, because if we just don't feel like giving money to someone, to say a homeless man, and we say, you know, because we think they're just going to go buy alcohol or drugs or something like that, we have to be careful about that. Do we really believe that? Are we just saying that because we don't feel like giving? And we're just using that as a mask. So we have to use our best judgment. And it helps to be around other people who know the vows and who are keeping them too. And it's also, when you're around people who aren't, they're most likely not going to understand why you're doing something or not doing something. So what I've found, in most cases, it's better to just do it on my own and not explain to them why I'm doing something. You know, if they ask, I'll explain. But I find usually what happens is they don't understand why I'm doing it, and so they'll try to talk me out of it or something like that. You know, like, oh, they're, like, I don't usually think that about homeless people asking me for money. If I have it, I'll try to give it. I'm not always good with it. I have, like, you know, blocks that come up. But someone else I'm with will say, don't give them money. They're just going to go and spend it on alcohol. Or, you know, something like that. So in a lot of situations, you just do what you think is right and don't go out of your way, I say, to explain to everyone. Unless they're interested and they want to know, then of course. So the motivation, you must be overwhelmed by feelings of stinginess because you don't want to part with what you have. So in this one, they have to specifically ask you for something. If you see a need and they don't ask, you're not breaking the vow. So that's to break this vow. The conditions, they get more and more narrow. So they do have to approach you personally and ask you personally for this. I mean, if you see someone in need and you can help them, of course it's a good thing to help them. But unless they're personally asking you, you're not breaking this vow.
So like someone who's just holding up a sign, I mean, it's not necessarily a personal request for their car to car.
Right. I think that that would fall under the not the personal request. Yeah. Yeah, and then if they ask you and come up to your car and ask you, then that would be personal. And then in the case of the Dharma, you don't want to teach everyone everything that you know, because then you won't be the one who knows it. You won't be so great. They'll know what you know, that sort of thing. And it's not a condition to break the vow that the other person's hopes are dashed or something like that. That's not necessary. There are teachings, which I haven't heard, but there are teachings that say that that is necessary. Like when you say no to assist them or you say no to teaching them, that they're let down. But that's not true. There's no scriptural reference for that. So really, there's two parts, not giving Dharma, not giving material things. Basically, you let the other people suffer because of your attachment and your greed. Okay. We'll probably go over one more, and then we'll take a break. Okay, so the weak can never forgive. Forgiveness is the attribute of the strong. Which anyone who's tried to forgive knows this. It's not an easy thing to do. But it's flipped. It's like backwards in our society, I think. It's thought that forgiving someone is the weakness. But it takes way more strength to forgive someone, way more. It's easy to stay pissed and be angry and not forgive. That goes, like, with our natural tendency of anger and hatred.
I mean, if you get over it, you need some understanding. You need some understanding. You know, and have some understanding for what the whole situation was, who they were, who you are, what motivation, all that. And if you don't have that,
yeah.
It becomes hard to get. And sometimes you just collapse and become angry. And it's
right. Yeah, it's not easy.
Yeah.
Yep. So number three is striking another person or staying angry when they try to explain and apologize for something they did. So this one sounds a little stickier. It's when your anger is built up over time and eventually you strike this person or you throw something at them. So this vow has two parts. somebody did something bad to you. You got angry. The anger built up. You didn't let it go. You held it. And at some point, you actually did violence to them. So you hit them, you threw something, or you got someone else to do something to them. And then, so if this has happened to you, you probably know that it feels really bad. And it just feels wrong when this happens. I've smacked people, even not out of anger, like just on the arm or something like that. And every time I've done that, I get a feeling of like, I get a piece of what I think he's talking about here. It's like this, I don't know, just something not quite right feeling.
What if it's not a physical action, but a, like a verbal thing, you know, like a retort or something, or a combative verbal thing? Like, is that kind of fall into that same category, or are we just talking about a physicality?
This one, well, it says you're striking them or you're staying angry. So if you're staying angry at them when they try to explain and apologize, and that's the, like the retort part,
okay,
then that would be this. But I find with this vow, the striking another person literally is not a hard one for me. Concentric circles, yeah, that's difficult because I'm not. You know, I've never, like, fought with people really physically. I've never done that, so it's not a thing that's in the habit for me. But, you know, saying sharp things to people or having anger or hatred towards someone, that would be an outer circle, and definitely I do those things, for sure. But staying angry with them when they try to explain and apologize for something, that, I think, it makes things a lot easier because I have this vow, and so every time someone apologizes, I accept it every single time. And it just takes, like, I don't have to debate in my mind. I don't have to think about it. I just accept their apology. It doesn't mean that there's not still some anger there or something. And there might be times when we're too angry to be able to accept their apology. So we say, you can say something like, I'm just feeling a lot of anger right now. I need a little bit of time. And then you can go back and accept it later. So this one, I think that second part just makes things easier. So another thing, to break this one, it has to be a person and not an animal. Not that hitting animals is okay, but it's just not this vow. And in order to break this, they must sincerely explain or apologize. And you hang on to your anger anyways, even though they apologize. And it doesn't count that you're just pissed off and you don't think they're being sincere. I mean, if they're truly not, that's one thing. But just because you're still angry and so you want to think they're not being sincere, it still counts. Okay, so you wanna accept when you can. Or explain that I just need like a little bit of time, something like that. So you break the vow when you refuse the apology and you stay angry, or when you stay angry and you strike the person. Both are not necessary, it's either one. Or you could do both. So anger is the main affliction with this vow. This one's it's a really good practice in the car to just preemptively forgive people. Because, preemptively, you're not going to talk to the people in the car in front of you. If it's someone you know, you're probably not going to get mad at them anyways. But someone cuts you off or, you know, whatever drivers do, and you feel like some anger coming up, you can just say, I forgive you. You know, you're not going to push the anger down and not feel it. But you're not following it. You can kind of direct it towards forgiveness. Like, just get in the habit of doing that when you have anger come up throughout the day. And then when something big comes up, it'll be a habit. It'll be a lot easier. And sometimes, even though that habit's good, when the good habit comes up of being forgiving and just saying, I forgive you, there can also be that negativity that comes up with that forgiveness of like, man, I wish I hadn't just forgiven them. You know, there can also be that sort of thing that comes up. Or I wish I'd just yelled at them. Or I should have hit them or done something. You know, so that can also come up. It doesn't mean that what you did was wrong. What you did was the right thing. It's just there's that habit of feeling like we have to, I don't know, like get even with people or something. Which is, from a karmic perspective, what are we doing in that situation? If someone sincerely apologizes to us about something, they feel really bad. What are we planting if we are not forgiving them? What type of seed are we going to see?
People not accepting our apology.
Right. We're going to see people not being forgiving. We're going to see the next time we apologize to someone and we really want their forgiveness, they're going to say no. And the seed grows, so it'll be bigger. They'll say no even more harshly than we did. So in a way, it's our self-interest of doing this. But in the moment, it's also a great kindness to the other person. Because when you go to apologize, like, it sucks to have to go and apologize to people for things that you've done. And when you're sincerely apologizing, it's such a relief for someone to just say, okay, you know, I forgive you. So that one, I mean, all of these can be difficult. So this one, I think, is out of these three, I think this one is probably the easiest one to break.
Personality.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah. In my opinion, this one seems the easiest. What do you guys think? Bernardo thinks something different.
Well, I think challenge for me would be number two.
The material thing.
Sorry, number one.
Oh.
Yeah.
Praising others.
Yeah.
Or not praising others. Praising yourself. And putting others down. Yeah.
I'm going to be struggling.
Mm-hmm.
But that has the end, so you also have to be putting the other person down. So, for example, I mean, you could say, take joy in doing virtuous effort, but you're not saying, I'm better than someone else who didn't do the virtuous effort.
Right.
So it requires that and.
Right, right. And then there's the two different motivations.
Right.
Yeah, right. All right. So let's take a break. Oh yeah, we'll get through these. Cool. Jacket on too, but. I think with the smaller class, it should be a little warmer. Okay. Does anyone have any other questions you want to ask?
I kind of have a question about keeping the vow.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, in the vow book, what's a good way to work with, like, when you're working the concentric circles and you write how you maybe didn't keep the vow?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, like, with the refuge vows, I have a really hard time coming up with, like, I start coming up with a way, but then it seems, like, really harsh or something towards myself.
Like, are you thinking of a particular vow?
That's not a good version of, like, the harsh one. Um, like, well, I'll use this one. So, like, keeping a Buddhist worldview. Mm-hmm. And then if there's, like, a time when I'm not actively thinking about emptiness, then I'll write that. But then it starts to become, it feels like the quality of the feeling towards it becomes really, like, punitive or something. Like, a way to write it internally.
So do you write it down just, like, in general, I'm not keeping this worldview, or are you using, like a specific example?
Yeah, I'll write, like, the last hour and a half of when I went to the grocery store, I had a moment of, like, thinking about the things working this way.
So that would be the positive?
No, it would be, like...
Oh, that like, they work not the way that they do.
Not the way that they
end. Okay. So, I think that there is, I kind of feel like there's a thing that happens too, where we go from blaming everybody else for everything, and then we kind of flip into blaming ourselves for everything when we're starting, but when we're in a Buddhist practice. I get that sense with myself sometimes, and I've seen it recently where, like, I went out with a friend, and I wasn't feeling that good, and she wanted to sit outside. It was cold out. She wanted to sit outside because she had her dog. And immediately I just said yes because I felt like I was supposed to do that.
Yeah.
And I just, like, dissed what I was thinking and feeling.
Yeah.
And then I didn't, like, I kind of got a little more sick after that.
Yeah.
And I was like, I just assumed that I had a bad intention.
Yeah.
So exactly. I think there's a way where we flip into that, and that's, I think that's just blaming or harsh in a different way.
Yeah.
And not so helpful. So that's what, because we have the two side channels, and so we're going to be unbalanced. We're going to flip into one, from one completely to the other, and then we'll start to kind of like even out more in the middle.
Mm.
And I think we start evening out when we start to notice that we're doing it, or that it feels harsh the way we're practicing. So what I would say, which it sounds like you're doing, is picking like one specific example that that was like an unpleasant situation.
Mm.
So some way that like at the grocery store, maybe you got angry with someone who got in front of you in line or something like that. Like you're both walking up and they kind of like went a little bit faster and got in front of you, which we get mad about those things, or I do. So maybe that sort of thing happened and it was unpleasant. And so use something like that where it's not like, it's like this situation, I got upset and I wish I hadn't done that because I'm planting those seeds to feel upset in the future. It didn't feel good then.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to see myself doing it differently.
Okay.
So I'll visualize myself. This person walks up and I just, like, not that I necessarily have to do anything. I just purposely, like, slow down a little so I let them go in front. So they go in front. Like, right worldview in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to soften it a little or switch it to where it's not, like, automatically putting like a harsh blame on yourself, because that's what I've noticed recently with myself too. It's like I'll automatically flip to blaming myself, and I think I see other people who are practicing Buddhism and have been for a while doing the same thing, as though that's more virtuous than blaming other people. And I don't really think it is in the long run. In the short run, I think we flip from blaming everyone else for our problems, which is a good thing because it's not everyone else, but it's also not like, it's not necessarily me right now either. It's seeds from the past, maybe from past lives, and me blaming myself harshly is just going to plant the seeds for harsh blame in my future. I'm just going to have to see that more. So it's not like it's a virtuous thing to be blaming ourselves either.
Yeah. Like, when I feel it come up, I stop tracking the minuses and, like, try to focus. But then I feel like, well, now are you just, like, doing that because you don't want to think hard enough and it takes, like, 10 minutes to come up with a way you could have broken
it. Yeah.
So do you always write a positive and a negative?
I do, but sometimes the negative is just like if I feel like I need to rejoice, mm-hmm. sometimes the negative is just like, no negative, none.
Okay.
And then my to-do is like, yay, okay. And that's it.
Okay.
So I'll do that sometimes too.
That's helpful.
But I think it's helpful if you do it in a way where, look at like the interesting things that are happening in your life or, you know, like mm-hmm. the things that you want them to change. Well, you know, like actively you'd like them to change as opposed to, not that those aren't important, but like seeing this, I see this coming at me basically when it's coming from me, you know, the labeling.
Yeah.
It's not self-existently this glasses case. So that's very important. And it's not really that juicy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just like, okay.
Yeah.
But when I'm upset about something and I think of it in that sense, then it's a lot more helpful. And it's not like a sense of blaming. It's just I've had this habit for eons and it's coming up again.
Mm-hmm.
And even just like I'm going to visualize myself doing the opposite. And that can be the makeup activity and the refraining
okay.
from doing it in the four powers.
Okay.
See, that would be the four powers, like, I wish I hadn't done that. I just did that thing. I wish I hadn't. And then I can see myself doing it differently. Because I'm actively doing something, and I'm refraining from doing it the other way at the same time. So it could be the positive and the negative in one. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I also thought, as you're saying that, like, is this what you're saying? Like, it could be helpful to, like, find things in the environment that are like negative seeds ripening. So like if I hear a lot of yelling or something,
mm-hmm.
then to start working with it maybe that way too.
Yeah. So like you could think about it like what ways if you do the four powers as your makeup. That's my makeup a lot
okay.
is the four powers. So refuge, regret, and then you're going to refrain and make up activity or restitution. So you can just think, I planted the seeds for this noise and I regret it because it's unpleasant. You know, maybe it seems like my dog doesn't like it or my boyfriend or, you know, whoever. So what are the ways where I'm being too loud or noisy for other people. You know, maybe like interrupting them. And so I'm not going to do that for however long I can, the next minute or something like that. And I'm going to give people space for that same amount of time. And then after the minute, or you can just see yourself doing it, then rejoicing and feeling like, cool, purified and, you know, that's done. And then if it comes back, you just do the four powers again. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Number four, is rejecting the Mahayana teachings. And the way that you reject it is you say it's invalid or by teaching false dharma. You reject either of the two great divisions of Mahayana teachings on emptiness or on the bodhisattva path or life. So for the first one, to say it's invalid, you say that the Buddha never taught it. It's not good. It doesn't help people. I don't believe that the Buddha said that. And when you're teaching false dharma, you're making up your own interpretation of the teachings and you're teaching it as dharma. And I see what seems to be borderline of this happening kind of easily because people think that we need to modernize Buddhism or we need to change it so that more people are interested in it, or just making up your own interpretation of it. I don't know that I've really seen any teachers doing that. But I'd say, you know, practitioners, I think it's a lot easier to do it. If you're teaching, you're, in a way, I think you're kind of held to a higher standard while you're teaching, and there's like this, I don't know, maybe it's just how I was trained from mommy, but, you know, it's like more formalized. Whereas if we're just talking to someone one-on-one, it's a lot easier to just kind of, we don't like a certain teaching, so we kind of just change it and we say it's this other thing. And the point we talked about last week, teaching false dharma. So you're making up your own interpretation is majorly dissing the Buddha, because as we talked about, he can see all time and space. So everything he taught, he was teaching to us sitting here in this room right now, knowing exactly what we needed, knowing exactly what we needed to learn, what we needed to hear. So why would it need to be updated or changed? It's good the way it is, and it's powerful the way it is. And if we start changing it, then it loses its power and it's just not going to work. So the teachings work the way they've been taught, and our job, if we're passing them down or if we're practicing, is to practice them correctly. If we want to, you know, like mush together different religions or practices, we can do whatever we want, but just not saying that this is Buddhism or saying that these are the teachings when we know they're not. So that's basically what this one is. So it's kind of like, I really haven't been around other Dharma centers that much either. So I don't know, maybe this happens, but it's like someone thinks it would be cool to add something or update it. And that doesn't mean, like giving updated examples, that's different, that's fine. You're keeping the teachings the same, you're staying true to the teachings, you're just giving more modern examples so that we can relate to it. That's not changing them. But if you're completely changing the teachings, like you don't think someone's going to like them or something like that, then that's not. That would be this. So the point here, too, is that each generation has passed down Buddhism in a very pure way. So we don't want it to be completely corrupted when it gets to us, and then it's passed down, corrupted to the next generation. So we want it to stay pure, just the way it's come to us, which is why it works. It's because it stayed pure. So the way that we deal with this is, especially when we're teaching, and this is kind of a hard one to remember, but to say specifically, this is my interpretation or this is my experience, to be clear about it. It's not that we don't have our own experience, our own interpretation, that's fine, but we don't mush it together and say, this is what the Buddha taught or this is Buddhism. We just say, this is my understanding. So just to be very clear about it and not pass off our own ideas as the scripture of the Buddha. And the last line in the Vinaya says, apply this philosophy for your times and your days, but don't change the meaning. And we must know all the rules for doing that. Okay. Did you guys see this movie? It is so funny. I haven't seen it in so long.
It's
but
one of Dan's favorites whenever he's going through the guide. If it's on, he'll flip right to that channel and watch it. I think I've seen it.
Yeah. Do you see it? I remember it being hilarious, but it's been so long now. I don't know if it's still be funny. And he's a lawyer, right? Yeah. Yeah.
The pen is blue. That's one of the things I always think about. He's trying to say it's a red pen, but the pen is blue.
Okay. So to break this vow, the one we were just talking about, that you're rejecting the Mahayana teachings by saying they're invalid or you're teaching false dharma, this is how you break it. A, you know that you made it up. I know I made this up. So it's not that you're just confused and then you remember later, oh shoot, I said that and that actually wasn't true and I'm just realizing it now. It's not that. It's that you know you made it up. You like the idea. I made this up. Awesome. I'm going to teach it to others. So you teach it to others as Mahayana Buddhism and the others accept it. That's how you break it. So it's not totally like impossible to do, but not that easy. So to break it, you know you made it up, you like the idea, you teach it to others as Mahayana Buddhism. And they accept it. So all of that has to happen to break this one. Bernardo looks nervous.
What if you're not aware of that?
What if what?
You're not aware.
Then it wouldn't be full, because number one, you have to know that you made it up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it has to have all those. It would be close, but it wouldn't be breaking it. So a good one with this one. I think a good habit in general is just to get into the habit of, it's a fine line, but of not being, not saying things like you're completely sure all the time. You know, like if you're, if someone's talking about Buddhism and you bring something up and you're not totally sure that it's from Buddhist scripture, just to err on the side of, I'm not totally sure where I heard this. I think it was in Buddhism, but I don't remember exactly. And then say what you're going to say. That sort of thing. So to not, you know, like there's this way where there's some power in just like being sure about it all the time, which is one thing. But in this sort of situation, when you're talking about teachings, better to just err on the side of, I think this is from the Buddhist teachings, but I'm not totally sure. But it's blah, blah, blah. You know, that sort of thing. So you're being upfront and you're explaining. And then you're protecting yourself from breaking this one. Okay. So this is, it also specifies that you're teaching it to others as Mahayana Buddhism. Because I guess we're probably not going to be teaching another form of Buddhism because we're not learning that, but it does specify that. So the main mental affliction here is ignorance. We must, at all costs, we must keep and teach the Dharma purely and strictly without any corruption or change from the original in the slightest. Which I really like that that's in the teachings, because then it gives you a sense of confidence that they've come down in a pure way too. And then, you know, we're all responsible for carrying them on. Okay. Doesn't this slide work out like perfectly? I didn't even know that he was going to match. And like fit right there. Okay. Number five is stealing the belongings of the three jewels. Images of the Buddha, the books, the temple objects, etc. Stealing from any of the three jewels breaks this vow. So there are, in fact, three different parts. It could refer to a painting of the Buddha or books for Dharma, It doesn't refer to the ultimate meanings of the jewels, which are enlightened beings, your understanding of emptiness, and those who have seen emptiness. It doesn't refer to those. And the motivation must be something bad, bad thought or a klesha. If you steal with the motivation to help others, it may not be the best thing, but it's not breaking this vow. And there's no mention of a minimum amount that counts as stealing. But it seems to refer more often to a chair or a painting or something more like that. The motivation is that you want the thing, you can use stealth or force to steal it. And the vow is broken when you think, now I have it, it's mine. Which, you know, it's kind of sick. If the vow's broken when you think that. So I think that's kind of a protection. You know, even if under some circumstance we somehow did this, the likelihood that we're going to think something like that, I don't know. Especially after having this training, this sort of training, you know, we'd probably feel really terrible. All right, next one, number 6. Giving up the Dharma of the listeners or the self-made Buddhas or the Mahayana teachings. You give it up by saying that this isn't the teaching of the Buddha. You have to deny the validity of the whole listener's path, not just one aspect of the teaching. So a classic example is the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. That would be a listener Dharma teaching, the first teaching that the Buddha did. Do you guys know why they're called listeners?
Because they're no longer in the path of...
No. Because they can listen to the Dharma... they can even teach the Dharma, but they can't practice it. They're incapable of practicing it themselves, which is very sad.
So I'm lost. So that's
the listener.
So
that's the definition.
A listener,
I don't. I wouldn't say so.
Would it be like a teacher?
No, it would be. It would. It would be anyone who can hear and maybe even teach the Dharma. They can hear Mahayana being taught. They can describe it to others, but they're incapable of practicing it. Bernardo, I'd say you're capable of practicing it. I think you do.
So could this be like other beings, for example, like nature spirits or those types of things who can hear the teachings, but...
I don't think that's what it's referring to. I think it's mostly referring, what I've heard it in reference to is mostly Hinayana practitioner. But it does say that they can hear Mahayana being taught. They just are not capable of practicing it. So that would be a listener. And then, does anyone know what the self-made Buddhas are?
No.
Linda?
Does it have something to do with like sugarcane bodhicitta?
No. It is, so they're not self-made and they're not Buddhas, but they're practitioners in this life. That they don't have a teacher in this life. They've had countless teachers in past lives. And they're not a Buddha yet, but they do have some high level of realizations. So that's what listeners and self-made Buddhas are.
So they haven't reached enlightenment, but they're on the path there, and they just don't have a teacher?
And the classic teaching of the self-made Buddhas is the 12 links of dependent origination, which is what Geshe Sultram was teaching us when he was here. So they aren't Buddhas and they aren't self-made. They don't have omniscience and they can't reach enlightenment in this life, but they can reach nirvana.
So with the first part of it, the jnana practitioner?
Yep, which would be both the listeners and the self-made Buddhas.
That's what we are, self-made Buddhas. That's what we are.
So is that like, so anyone who practices jnana is...
Mm-mm. No, I'm not really sure why it just mentions those two.
Okay.
Because it is kind of,
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
I don't know why it's just separating out listeners and self-made Buddhas. My understanding is that those are two types of Hinayana practitioners, but they're not all of Hinayana practitioners. So I'm not sure why it just says listeners or self-made Buddhas or the Mahayana teachings.
What I don't understand is the concept of the whole phrase is giving up the Dharma. So not believing in the listeners and the self-made Buddhas and the teachers?
Well, you're saying...
Not recognizing...
So you're saying that their path is not valid.
Oh.
That they're not the teachings of the Buddha.
Okay.
So I believe when I've asked Ami about this, she said that they're talking about the Hinayana path. I don't know what your confusion is, but mine is that it's just mentioning listeners and self-made Buddhas, but my understanding is that that's not all of the Hinayana path practitioners. So I'm not really sure why it's separating out those two. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, because I was hearing it, I was like, oh, anyone who practices Hinayana.
That's how I've understood this vow, okay. And I think when I've asked Ami, that's how she said it.
Okay.
But I will try to remember to ask her,
okay.
And if you guys remember, remind me, and I'll send her an email. So basically, it's talking about. It says the classic example of these two are the teachings on the Four Noble Truths and the 12 links of dependent origination. So the likelihood that any of us would say that those were not spoken by the Buddha is really low, because we all know that we all know where they came from. So it's also saying, or the Mahayana teachings though. So it's saying that any part of, I think how we could take this is of the whole path, because the Hinayana path and the Mahayana path, well, you know, I guess except for the Vajrayana path, but that makes up the open teachings basically. So we could look at this vow, this is my interpretation right now, but we could look at it as dissing any of the teachings and saying that they weren't spoken by the Buddha, that they're not true. We don't believe them. They're rubbish. That sort of thing. So it would be putting down the teachings.
So Heather, how is this different than number four in the sense of rejecting the Mahayana? Because that was one is rejecting. This one is giving up. So this one sounds more like both of them we've been following the path, but I guess this one just sounds like, instead of saying, oh, it's not valid, we're saying, well, we're just not going to follow it anymore. And I don't know if there's really...
You mean...
A difference in that.
This one is saying you're giving it up?
That's how I'm seeing it. Is that not...
Yeah, I think they do seem similar, but number four, you're saying that you're rejecting it, saying that it's not valid, that it's only the Mahayana teachings. It's not valid, the Buddha never taught it, it's not good, blah, blah, blah. Or you're teaching false dharma.
Okay.
So you're saying, those are separate. But on one hand, you're rejecting the Mahayana teachings, and on the other, you're teaching false dharma. You're saying, these are the teachings when they're really not, that sort of thing. So it doesn't have to be both, but it could be. And then with this one, I actually, this one is saying giving up the dharma of the listeners or self-made Buddhas or the Mahayana teachings. Which, when I think of this vow, I never remember the Mahayana teachings part, honestly. But that's how Geshe Michael presented it, so it must be in there. So in this one, it seems like the focus is more on the Hinayana path. It's saying that that whole path is not valid. That's my take on it. Let me look in the, my computer won't connect. It's still reconnecting.
Ami was telling me one time that, like, there can be practitioners who have practiced for, like, 20 plus years, and then one morning they wake up and they're like, this is garbage. They have a completely different experience of it. And it's like a mental affliction or like Mara, and they're just like, I'm never gonna meditate again, and they've been like a meditator for years, and
oh my god, it's terrifying.
Yeah. And she said like the higher if you're on between level 5 and 6, she said like
that, in meditation.
Mm-hmm, that's like a, I don't know if she's the word common, but that it can happen there.
Like an obstacle that comes up around those levels.
Yeah. But this kind of makes me think of that, like, you have the vows and you're now giving up, like, the idea.
Yeah.
Like, you're like, no, that was, I don't know what I was thinking, that was whatever.
I know, gosh.
It's really scary.
It is. Because in order to get to those, well... No, you don't necessarily have to be practicing your morality well to get to the higher levels of meditation. So maybe, you know, that's like the protection.
Yeah.
Are the vows and keeping your morality. Because meditation in and of itself is just focus. You know, like you could build up shamatha and get to those levels without truly practicing, even though you think you're practicing, but you're not keeping your ethics or your morality or... You know, you've like stripped it, so maybe that's the safety. I know, gosh. So I'm not totally clear on the Mahayana teachings part on this one. The way I see them is the one is talking about Mahayana, and then this one's talking about Hinayana. But is this the one that I already said remind me in Alaska me? Mm-hmm. Or is that the last one? Okay. Yeah. So on this one, I'll double check on this one. Because I'm curious too. Yeah, because in the explanation of it, Geshe Michael says, you must say that the listeners aren't following the Buddha's teaching overall, or that the self-made Buddhas or the Mahayana, that it's not a path taught by the Buddha. You have to be putting down either.
Okay.
So that doesn't really clear up our question, but... Okay, so let's go to the next one. And this one is, okay, I think we'll make it. It's taking the golden robes away. So from what Geshen Michael says, the real outside robe of what the monks wear is golden. So that's what it's talking about. So you're taking their robes away by telling them to take them off. Just physically to remove their robes. It doesn't mean to make them become a layman. So they don't lose their vows by physically taking off their robes. Or taking them off yourself or making them give back their vows and become a layperson. This part, the second part, you're having them disrobe, and the motivation would be anger. This would be like what the Chinese did to the Tibetans. You must have the desire to hurt them in all of these cases, or be physically hurting them by beating them, etc. Both have to be done with the motivation of harm. You want to harm them. And whether the person is a good monk or nun, or a bad monk or nun, it doesn't matter. Like, for example, you know that they've broken all these vows, and you tell them they have to disrobe, you still break this vow. And if in some, you know, extraordinary case it's out of compassion, then you don't break the vow. So for these deeds, these next ones, you go to the lowest hell immediately after you die when you do these five, which we've heard of these before. So there's killing your father, your mother, an arhat, someone who's achieved nirvana, causing a schism among the Buddha's direct disciples, or trying to harm a Buddha. Okay? So for causing a schism among the Buddha's direct disciples, it has to be his direct disciples. It has to last at least 24 hours. So we can do this one, which is good. It's good when there's ones that are kind of freebies. We could create really horrible, bad seeds by causing a schism in the Sangha, but it wouldn't be this, wouldn't be breaking this. And then trying to harm a Buddha would be by drawing blood. So any one of them's breaking the vow, you don't have to do all five. I think we've come across this question before. I don't remember what we were talking about. Yeah, maybe.
And I think
anger towards a bodhisattva, right?
Right. Yeah.
And I don't know for sure, but I believe. I believe you don't have to perceive them as Buddha. If everyone around us was a Buddha and we didn't know. But I'm not totally sure, though. I'm not totally sure about that one. So, because when we were talking in the Karma course, and I can't remember what was from Geshe Michael's teachings and what was our conversation, but, you know, when you have an anger, a moment of anger towards a bodhisattva, it destroys eons of good karmic seeds, and it was brought up, well, what if you don't know they're a bodhisattva? Yeah.
necessarily know that you're planting a negative seed.
Right.
You're planted, so.
Right, you might not know the difference between right and wrong at a certain point, but when you're planting a negative seed, it's still planting a negative seed.
So
yeah.
It's not like, it doesn't meet all the criteria, but it's still there. Like,
what criteria do you mean?
Oh, no, I guess it would, because if you have the intention, I'm thinking of like all the...
To plant a strong seed?
Yeah.
Well... I think, so what I would say, it's probably not quite as strong as if you saw them as a Buddha. Because that would be, if you saw them as a Buddha, that would be a really bad thing to draw blood. Like, I mean, good rule of thumb is just like, don't stab anyone or, you know.
Yeah, it has to draw blood.
Right, okay. Right, yeah. Right, that's what it says, is that specifically trying to harm a Buddha is by drawing blood. So I think it's kind of tricky. It does, because I'm not totally sure, but if it's our perceptions planting the seed, you know, it's not like there's something outside of ourselves that's planting the karmic seed. Some other person who's watching or something like that. It's us who's planting the seed. And I don't know how we would, if we know on like some level that they're a Buddha, I don't know how that would work.
Mm-hmm. It's also our ignorance that we don't realize that that person's a Buddha.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense too. There's probably some more like mystical answer that I don't know. That would make a lot more sense. But in just planting karmic seeds, everything we think, say, or do is planting a karmic seed. And
someone.
You what?
And you're harming someone, whether you know if they're a Buddha or not.
Yeah, and it is, you know, it is said too that karma is like the most complex thing. We see emptiness before we see the workings of karma. Only a Buddha sees the inner workings of karma. So, I mean, with most of these, since that, you know, after studying for a while and seeing how everything's true, there's a sense where some of them you just take on faith at a certain point. There might be a more concrete answer to it, but I don't know of one. Because yeah, it's a good question. All right. Okay, let's do last one. I think that's it. Okay. So the last one is wrong view. And this is, like, out of ignorance, this is kind of how we live our lives. We think we're shooting the arrow towards the bullseye or doing something that's going to bring about the effect we want, and we're actually doing the opposite. So we're shooting in completely the opposite direction. Like we are annoyed with someone, and so we do something to get rid of them. When actually we're just planting the seeds for that to happen again in the future, that sort of thing. So the two classic worldviews, these are Geshe Michael says he's not sure if it's restricted to these two, but these are the two that Jason Coppa mentions. It's either denying the law of karma by believing that you can do anything and nothing will come of it, or denying past and future lives by saying that they don't exist. Doesn't mean that you have to be 100% sure about past and future lives, but just saying, I'm not completely sure, as opposed to no. And you must believe it from the bottom of your heart and not have any doubts. So if you're a good logician or a good Buddhist, you'd have to say, I'm not sure and I haven't worked it out logically yet. That wouldn't be breaking the vow. So this is how we're supposed to practice, by checking it out first. You can say, I'm going to shelve it for the time being, instead of saying, absolutely no, it's not true. All right. Do a short little meditation, like 2 minutes. So sit up nice and tall. Put your shoulders together. Up to your ears together and then down your back. And as we started, just doing a short scan down the body. Releasing and relaxing any holding in the physical body. Any tension in the forehead and the eyes. And scan back up. And get the sense that you're offering all the merit and understanding of emptiness to realizing the final goal of the path, being able to teach it to others. And offering that as
Jenny leads us in the prayers.
Sashi
Buki Chukshi Metok Tron Rira Ling Shin Yen Degen Padi Sange Shindu Mikte Uwagi Jokun Amdak Shingla Chuparshu Yidam Guru Radna Mandala Kam Niryasayami
Gewa
Di Gewoku Sunam Yeshe Sok Sok Shi Sunam Yeshe Lejungwe Tampa Kuni